This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Donald Trump just picked John Bolton as his national security advisor.
Of the 320-some million people in the United States, Trump couldn't have picked a more dangerous man.
We talk about a recent court victory for the necessity defense in environmental actions.
The necessity defense is that if you want to stop a larger crime, you're entitled to break the law. And in this one, the people won.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Michael, last week, Judge George Daniel in the Federal District Court here in New York ruled against Saudi Arabia in its motion to dismiss the lawsuit against it for enabling the attacks of September 11th, 2001. You were a plaintiff in the lawsuit, and you were injured. Tell us what happened to you.
Well, I was supposed to be having breakfast on Windows on the World, which is the restaurant on top of one of the Twin Towers, at 8 o'clock. And just as I was getting ready to get out of bed and go up to have breakfast, you know, the plane hit the tower at 8:40. My friend John called and said he had a board meeting and he couldn't come to breakfast. So he canceled the breakfast. I thought, well, maybe I'll go myself. Maybe I'll go up there with my wife. And we were just too lazy. So we were laying in bed, and actually the plane that hit the tower flew right over our apartment building. We lived right across the street. We could see the underbelly of the plane. So I went downstairs, came back and reported to my wife that evidently a small plane had hit the tower. Went back to bed, and then the other plane came and hit the other tower. The first building stayed up, but the second building that was hit fell down first. The whole area where we lived was cloudy. You couldn't see out the window. It was totally dark. Then when the second building fell, it had lightened up and it got dark again. The lawns, the roofs were covered in ash. It was like a snowstorm. We were told you should evacuate. But I had a 16-pound cat, Charlie Parker, my talking parrot. We really couldn't go anywhere, so we stayed overnight. Everybody in our building was removed except us and a blind jazz musician. The next day, the police came and they told us you really had to leave. But we couldn't carry the cat. He was too big. So we walked out with the bird up to the village to stay with Michael Ratner and Karen Renucci in their apartment. And along the way, Charlie was telling everybody, it's okay, it's okay. But it wasn't okay, and that's the story I want to tell you. First, Charlie got sick with a lung disease. Then our cat died. I didn't feel well, couldn't swallow, had to have a procedure. Evidently, the nerves in my esophagus were killed from breathing in all that toxic dust. But we went on, and then we learned that 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. Meanwhile, Bush and others like John Bolton were trying to sell us on the story that Iraq was behind the war. In the meantime, a group of women from New Jersey, survivors whose husbands were killed in the Twin Towers, organized to get a law passed allowing the survivors to sue Saudi Arabia. That suit was instituted by these women and others. I later joined with 6,500 survivors and injured people, and the Saudi Arabians made a motion to dismiss. That was the big victory last week when Judge Daniels ruled that the lawsuit could go forward.
Michael, discovery is going to start immediately?
Absolutely, and it's on fast track. The lawsuit contended that the Saudi Arabian government and elements of it enabled the hijackers. And the main hook in the lawsuit, because a lot of this stuff was kept secret, but the main hook was the fact that two Saudi Arabian government officials in San Diego helped the hijackers, helped two of them. These two men did not speak English. They came from Saudi Arabia to San Diego, and two of the Saudi Arabian government officials helped them find an apartment, set up a bank account, helped them learn English, helped them get into flight school. And this was discovered when an FBI agent went out to San Diego and interviewed some people out there. Initially, Robert Mueller told him don't do it, but he went anyway and found out this connection. The FBI went over to Saudi Arabia because the people in Saudi Arabia who were in the United States enabling the attack all left the country immediately. And in fact, 65 of them were on board a special plane that Bush allowed them to fly out on. But in any case, these two people were back in Saudi Arabia. The FBI went out to interview them, and they weren't particularly truthful. The FBI said they were lying. It was not an interview that was taken under oath. Well, this lawsuit enables the plaintiffs to question these people under oath to find out what their connections are.
If you can just describe America's relation to Saudi Arabia and how this lawsuit might impact it.
Saudi Arabia is a major purchaser of American weapons. The last year of the Obama administration, they purchased $110 billion worth of weapons. And just 2 weeks ago, Trump announced the sale of another $11 billion worth of weapons to them. So they are a major consumer of American weapons, many of them being used now against the people of Yemen. But they're also a major American ally in the Middle East, and they figure centrally in the plans that are being hatched, I believe now, and we'll learn further in our interview with Phyllis Bennis, but the plans to attack Iran. Israel is interested in doing this. Saudi Arabia is interested in doing it because Iran is their major opponent in the Middle East, and the United States, particularly Bolton, is advocating for bombing Iran. So Saudi Arabia is an ally of the United States. It's an arms purchaser of the United States. And as this lawsuit progresses and the truth about Saudi Arabia comes out, it's going to make it awfully hard for the Saudis to purchase more weapons from the United States and awfully hard for the Saudi Arabians to be an ally in the United States in a future war against Iran. So this lawsuit is extremely central.
Thank you, Michael.
In these unsettling times, it was particularly disturbing to a lot of people to learn last week that President Trump chose John Bolton to replace General H.R. McMaster as his national security advisor. Trump also replaced Secretary of State Rex Tillerson with the neocon CIA Director Mike Pompeo. It'll be remembered that John Bolton was instrumental in getting the USA to attack Iraq on the pretext that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction and ties with the terrorist organization Al-Qaeda. Bolton now alleges that Iran is building nuclear bombs and advocates for preemptively bombing Iran, which would be an illegal act of aggression. To speak with us about John Bolton and the implications for American war policy is Phyllis Bennis. She's a writer and activist and a fellow at the Washington, D.C. progressive think tank, the Institute for Policy Studies. She directs the New International Project there. Phyllis Bennis writes about issues relating to the Middle East and the United Nations. She wrote the book Understanding the U.S.-Iran Crisis, a primer. She has contributed articles to The Nation magazine, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and Counterpunch magazine.
Phyllis Bennis, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you.
Phyllis, we're curious, what was your first thought when you heard that John Bolton was chosen by Trump to be National Security Advisor?
My first thought wasn't a thought, it was a feeling. It was fear. Of all of the terrible things that has happened with this administration, all of the horrific appointments, by ideological extremists and unqualified people. This was the one that made me really basically afraid in the pit of my stomach that this is a call for war. That was my first thought.
Bolton has famously said that if the top 10 floors came off of the UN building, it wouldn't make any difference. Now, the UN was founded, as we know, after World War II, in which 65 million people died, and it was founded to prevent war. The U.S. took initiative to establish it. Nevertheless, the U.S. has ignored the law of nations and in 2003 attacked Iraq. What was Bolton's position in that war then and now?
Well, I think the quickest way to say that is, number one, Bolton's position has not changed since between then and now. But just to go back for a second to the issue of the U.N., I think it's important to recognize that the U.N. has always been both a subject and a venue for huge contradictions. You're right, Heidi, when you say that the U.N. was created to end war. But that was one part of why the U.N. was created. It's why the U.N. was supported by progressives around the world, by people who had been struggling against colonialism around the world, by people like Eleanor Roosevelt, who saw the creation of an institution that could protect internationally recognized human rights, supported the UN. All of that was a wonderful process. But there was another side of it that we should not forget, and that was, as you say, the U.S. was the main driver to create the UN, and the UN was created very much to protect the power of those who had won the war, those who had won World War II, and to keep the losers suppressed. So to keep Japan down, to keep Germany down. And it became quickly a venue for the Cold War between two of the so-called winners, the U.S. and the Soviet Union. But it was very much seen as an instrument of U.S. power and U.S. policy for all those years. In my book on U.S. domination of the U.N., it was one of the things that is the most consistent when you look at the history of U.S. relations with the global institution, is that U.S. power was always going to be supreme at the U.N., and that hasn't changed. So it was in that context that Bolton was first pointed to be the ambassador to the U.N. after a long history of trying to undermine it in the interest of war. And you can look at examples. One of the examples was in 2002, in the run-up to the war, the U.S. is desperately trying, along with the Brits, to get the U.N. Security Council to support war. They're trying very hard to get public support for war against Iraq. One of the big efforts is to get people to believe this false claim about Iraq's so-called weapons of mass destruction. That included the claim that, oh my God, Iraq has chemical weapons. The head of the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons, which is a UN agency designed to do exactly that, it was a Brazilian diplomat, a guy named José Bustani. Bustani was working incredibly hard around that time to persuade the leadership in Iraq to actually join that organization, the agency that oversees the prevention of chemical weapons. If they had agreed, if Saddam Hussein's government had agreed, they would have had to accept really intrusive inspections over the whole country that would have, as we know now, proven once and for all that, no, there were no viable chemical weapons programs going on in Iraq. And it would have averted any claimed justification for the war. Knowing that, John Bolton, who was, ironically enough, wait for it, he was the head of disarmament at the State Department at the time. I mean, really, talk about ironic. But so he goes to Bustani's office. Bustani writes about this just a few years ago, actually. He goes to Bustani's office and says, you've got 24 hours to resign. And Bustani says, I'm not resigning. I was just reappointed to a second four-year term by 145 countries in this organization. I'm not resigning. I'm not going anywhere. And Bolton says, oh, yes, you will. There will be consequences. And he goes out and uses time-tested methods of bribes and threats and punishments and gets enough countries to back it to pass a resolution firing Bustani and replacing him with somebody who was going to, you know, do exactly what the U.S. wanted, which was stop trying to persuade Iraq to join, stop trying to prove that there are no weapons of mass destruction, there are no chemical weapons. And the war goes forward. So it was a very affirmatively big effort by Bolton. It wasn't just he talked a lot about the need to go to war. He actually did stuff that made it happen. So that's been his history. More recently, of course, in 2015, at the time that the Iran nuclear deal was being negotiated, Bolton infamously wrote his piece in the New York Times saying, "Bomb Iran to stop Iran's bomb." All very clever. You know, this bombing Iran stuff brings out the worst of these people. This was like the John McCain thing, bomb, 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 Iran. You know, they think it's very clever, and it's really very, very dangerous. And then just a few weeks ago, Bolton wrote another big op-ed, this one in the Wall Street Journal, calling for a first strike against North Korea. So in every situation where there's an international issue that is complicated and dangerous, his first choice is let's go to war. His last choice, or never choice, is diplomacy.
Do you think that Bolton and Trump, who also agrees with him on this, will pull the United States out of the Iran deal?
I think Trump has already been leaning in that direction. I think having Bolton in the position of his national security advisor, which is a funny position, you know, it's, on the one hand, it doesn't have any actual power. The national security advisor can't tell the Pentagon what to do or tell the CIA what to do. But it's incredibly powerful because that person has the last word with the president. That's the person the president is supposed to rely on to bring together all the various pieces of information that the U.S. intelligence agencies, all 16 of them, have compiled, put together the various positions if there's disagreements, which there always are, within the intelligence community, and present it all in a coherent way to the president. That's how it's supposed to work. In the real world, you have these powerful national security advisors, people like Henry Kissinger with Richard Nixon, who orchestrated things like the assassination, the support for the Pinochet dictatorship and the assassination of our two comrades here at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington back in 1976. Kissinger knew about it. You know, these are the kinds of powerful individuals that can really mold the foreign policy options presented to the president, making that the inevitable choice that the president makes. In this case, it's particularly dangerous because, as you mentioned, Mike, the tendency of Trump is already to get out of the Iran nuclear agreement, to at least threaten war with Iran, if not move to carry it out or support Israel moving to carry it out. So it's an incredibly dangerous, powerful position for somebody like John Bolton. When he said those now famous words about you could lop off the top 10 floors of the United Nations, there is no such thing as the United Nations, there's only U.S. power, and sometimes we might choose to lead the U.N., that's the only time it exists. He said all that in a debate with me back in 1994. And at the time, it was shocking to hear it. But it was shocking and horrifying. I remember looking out from the stage and seeing a lot of horrified faces in this big audience of 1,000 supporters of the U.N., but at the same time, he was at the American Enterprise Institute, kind of cooling his heels, waiting for the next Republican administration in the White House who would appoint him to something. He wasn't in a position of power at that point, so it was horrifying, but it didn't have that sense of imminent fear that the recent announcements have had, knowing that he's now in a position of immediate access to enormous power.
Trump has recently replaced three key cabinet members, General H.R. McMaster, his national security advisor, Gary Cohn, and Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State. And some have called this a war cabinet. Do you agree?
Oh, I absolutely do. I mean, I think we have to be very careful as we get worse and worse appointments here that we not somehow lose sight of how bad the earlier ones were. It's partly, just on a side note, the rehabilitation of George W. Bush, I find extraordinarily dangerous right now. These constant shots of him dancing sweetly at some gala, whatever it was, that's been all over CNN, forgetting that where he should be is not dancing, but sitting in the dock in The Hague on trial for war crimes. The fact that things may be even worse now does not make it good, what happened then. And that's also true of the earlier appointments that Trump had made. This idea for people like McMaster and others that they were supposed to be the, quote, adults in the room, well, they didn't do much as adults in the room to restrain the really terrible and aggressive war policies that the Trump administration has put forward. It certainly is possible that, yes, it could have been worse. I would never be one to say it couldn't be worse. It can always be worse, and unfortunately it often is. But these were terrible policies. What we're seeing now is an even more explicit commitment to war as the first choice, to the abandonment of diplomacy. We should note that that's easier right now because of Rex Tillerson's willingness to accept the Trump administration's seemingly off-the-cuff kind of announcement that, oh yeah, we're going to cut the budget for the State Department by 30%. And Tillerson said, okay, 30%, that's fine, without trying to defend the notion of diplomacy. At a certain level, you can even decide to change your mind and decide that diplomacy should win out over war. But if you don't have any diplomats left because you've slashed your budget by almost a third, you're not going to have any diplomats to carry it out. So it's a very, very dangerous moment, and it's coming in the context of a set of objective conditions like the slashing of the State Department, the fact that ambassador positions around the world remain unfilled, that many of the key analytical seats in the State Department are unfilled because people have left, because they're so demoralized that there's no work to be done because diplomacy has been sidelined. This is a very, very dangerous moment, and this is definitely a move towards consolidating a war cabinet.
Phyllis, what do you think a war with Iran would look like, given that Iran is a large and well-armed country?
War with Iran would be nightmarish on a scale even beyond the war in Iraq. One of the big differences, of course, is that Iraq as a country and the population of Iraq had already faced over a dozen years of crippling economic sanctions that had driven the population to hunger, lack of work, the destruction of the infrastructure. The population was in much weaker position than the population of Iran, which, as you say, has, you know, there's been sanctions and there continue to be sanctions against Iran. There are huge challenges for the Iranian population, but it's not at the same level. These are not sanctions that are genocidal in their impact as were the sanctions against Iraq. So that part is a little bit different, but what it would mean for the people of Iran, you know, we don't know exactly what weapons would be used. We know that the U.S. has these new weapons. One is called the MOAB. The nickname is the Mother of All Bombs, which is the most powerful non-nuclear weapon ever used in combat that was recently used for the first time in Afghanistan. Would that be used in Iran? Iran is a highly urbanized country, unlike Afghanistan. Would it be, God forbid, used in a city with a huge civilian population? We just don't know what war there would look like. What we do know is that war would very quickly become regional because, of course, Iran is in the midst of a region that is significantly divided, particularly between supporters of Iran and supporters of Saudi Arabia in their competition as regional hegemons, if you will. Other countries would quickly be involved. Israel has made clear that it believes there should be military force used against Iran. This has been Benjamin Netanyahu's, the Israeli prime minister's, sort of single most consistent political claim to legitimacy, is he's the one who will fight back against Iran. He famously came to the United States in 2015 during the debate around the Iran nuclear deal and spoke as if it were a State of the Union address, where he actually brought guests to the Capitol, where he was addressing a joint session of Congress, without even notifying the White House. And it brought so much opposition, particularly from the Congressional Black Caucus, that 60 members of Congress skipped the speech, an unprecedented act of outrage towards the Prime Minister of Israel. He was so disdainful of Barack Obama and of the White House. But in the context of that, a war with Iran would become a regional and potentially dangerously could become a global war even more quickly than the horrific war in Syria became a regional and a global war.
Phyllis, in our remaining minutes, we want to touch briefly on Russia and China. When Trump was elected, we thought, well, at least as opposed to Clinton, he's not belligerent toward Russia. Your thoughts on the Russia situation?
Well, I think that he views Russia and the what he thinks the U.S. relationship with Russia should be from a thoroughly domestic, really personal perspective. At the he's been the one who's protected Russia, denied that Russia could be involved in any of the possibilities that have to do with election interference, any of the other things. Now suddenly he's shifted and he's willing to move against Russia in a number of diplomatic ways, including upping the number of diplomats that are being expelled, Russian diplomats expelled from the United States in the sort of diplomatic tit-for-tat withdrawal of diplomats. In the case of the U.S., Trump has now demanded that Russia pull out 60 diplomats from the United States, this in response to the poisoning of the former Russian double agent in London. And in that context, his actual position politically in terms of what should be the policy towards Russia remains really unclear at this point. I think what we do see is that Trump has tried to embrace a whole host of authoritarian leaders, including Sisi in Egypt, including Erdogan in Turkey, including Duterte in the Philippines, as well as some of the parties in Europe that are fighting for, these are right-wing authoritarian forces that are fighting for political power within various parliaments. And it's clear that he sees them as his counterparts in these countries. These are all men who are working to expand their own power, in several cases working to change the constitutions in China as well, change constitutions so that these leaders can be in power forever, essentially. And it doesn't seem to matter what the political and social conditions are, whether it's a sort of state capitalist country, whether it's a so-called socialist country, whether it's a thoroughly pro-U.S. neoliberal country. Whatever the economy is doesn't seem to matter. Whatever the political system is doesn't seem to matter. His affinity is for leaders who are showing the way globally, in his view, towards what it looks like to consolidate personal power and expand the length of time that one can be in power.
Before I conclude with a question that Heidi and I wanted to ask you about China, I just wanted to make an announcement that there is a unified anti-war movement that's called demonstrations, anti-war demonstrations, on April 14th and 15th in various cities around the country. And we urge our listeners to get involved in that. So to conclude, though, Phyllis, do you believe that Trump is also realigning U.S. policy towards China in a belligerent way?
You know, I think, again, it's very hard to judge, partly because of Trump's tendency to flip-flop, if you will, between different positions. And where he lands on any given day seems to have everything to do with who was the last person who spoke with him the night before, and what did he see on Fox and Friends in the morning when he gets up. It's determined by tweet. So we don't exactly know. What I think is true is that what we've seen in the year and a half that Trump has been in office is that the tendency towards isolationism that we started to see creeping out during his campaign does not include the military side. So it can be sort of isolationist when you're looking at economic relations, diplomatic relations, even cultural ties. This America first-ism does not include military isolationism. It doesn't include, despite the claim that he now says he's going to withdraw the troops from Syria, we'll see whether that really happens. I have my doubts. But in general, he is still taking a very belligerent position, including towards China, even in a period when he is trying to embrace Xi's position as the new leader for life. And it's a very dangerous moment because there's this huge contradiction between political embrace and still maintaining military threats in the South China Sea, relative to the islands that China has been creating, artificial islands to bolster their claim against the claims of the Philippines and Vietnam and others. It's a very dangerous moment, and I don't think we can rule out anything in terms of possible military escalations that could have far graver consequences that Trump or the people around him even anticipate.
Phyllis, on that sobering note, we wanted to conclude by asking you your final thoughts on this. Is there anything positive or anything in terms of activism that we can hope to see coming out of this news?
I think the activism is what gives us hope. I think the extraordinary mobilization led by young people against guns was incredible. For all of the limitations of what it didn't talk about the international use of U.S. weapons. It was an amazing mobilization with hundreds of thousands of people. Here in D.C., it was close to a million. They acknowledged there were 800,000. I'm guessing it was a million. Tons of young people in the crowd, only people under 18 who were speaking, and they were smart and politically astute, and they recognized their own privilege, recognized the importance of linking this question of guns to the question of racism, identifying communities that do not have access to the voice that they were able to claim because of their own privilege, and they brought in those voices to make sure they were heard as well. So that gives me incredible hope, not just in the long term for the future when these kids grow up and become voters and whatever, but because even now, they're showing the ability to build movements that are shaking up how this established set of social order functions. And we need to do that at the level of the anti-war movement. It's already happening with Black Lives Matter and others, in the anti-racist movement, in the Fight for 15, in the economic justice arena, in organizations that are mobilizing for climate justice. In all of these ways, we see it with the rise of the new Poor People's Campaign, led by Reverend William Barber and Reverend Liz Theo Harris, which is coming towards a 40-day period, a six-week period of civil disobedience around the country in state capitals, that's focusing on the evil triplets of Dr. Martin Luther King's Riverside speech, where he talked about the need to jointly oppose racism, poverty, and militarism, and then adding climate degradation to that. And it's bringing together thousands of people across the country from all kinds of movements so that the silos are being broken down. The intersection of these movements is emerging as the new normal for what movement building looks like. So I'm very optimistic about the possibility of these movements and the possibility of our movements linking with global movements that are doing the same thing, because after all, the U.S. remains the centerpiece of the empire, and whoever the president is here, people around the world know that they are affected as well. Our movements can and must be connected in the same way that the power relations are connected.
Well, Phyllis, as usual, that is beautifully put and gives us some inspiration.
As the Cubans say, we're in the same trench.
Indeed we are.
Phyllis Bennis, thank you so much for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you both. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Phyllis. Take it easy.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Environmental activists were recently found not guilty in actions protesting a gas pipeline in densely populated West Roxbury, Massachusetts. In 2015, they climbed into holes dug for the pipeline being built by the Houston-based company Spectra Energy. Judge Marianne Driscoll found them not responsible after hearing each one argue that their actions to try to stop climate change were a, quote, legal necessity. The so-called necessity defense is rarely accepted in U.S. courts. Defendants relying on this argue that they should not be held liable for their actions because their conduct was necessary to prevent a greater societal harm. In this case, the official court record will only state that charges were converted from criminal misdemeanors to civil infractions and that all defendants were found not responsible. But the judge did state from the bench and on the record that she was finding them not responsible on the basis of necessity. In response to that, environmentalist Bill McGibbon tweeted this message. Good golly! A few minutes ago, a Boston judge acquitted 13 pipeline protesters on the grounds that the climate crisis made it necessary for them to commit civil disobedience. This may be a first in America. Joining us today are Kelsey Skaggs, Executive Director of the Climate Defense Project, and Marla Markham, Director of the Climate Disobedience Center. They will discuss this victory and preparations leading up to it. Kelsey and Marla, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you.
Kelsey, please put this decision and the necessity defense in general in the context of environmental protest decisions across the country.
This decision is the first time that there has been an acquittal of activists based on necessity argument or by reason of necessity. So over the past decade or so, climate activists have begun to really push the use of the necessity defense in a variety of cases. So far, there hasn't been a criminal trial in which activist defendants successfully use the defense. We've run into a lot of problems with judges in the pretrial stage denying defendants the opportunity to bring that evidence to a jury. And in this case, the charges were originally criminal charges, but they were downgraded by the prosecutor's office to civil charges. However, the judge in that situation where there's not a jury trial but a judge instead, the judge did find that the defendants were not responsible, which is the civil equivalent of not guilty, by reason of necessity.
Marla, can you tell us a bit about the Climate Disobedience Center and what role it played in this particular action and generally in others?
The Climate Disobedience Center was literally founded in the wake of an attempt to get a climate disobedience necessity defense case before a jury. So in 2013, Ken Ward and Jay O'Hara blocked a coal shipment in off the southeast coast of Massachusetts with a lobster boat. And when they went to trial in 2014 for that action, the judge in the Fall River District Court had granted them a necessity defense, and the prosecutor, the district attorney, actually dropped the charges and announced that he was going to march with us in the People's Climate March. And we had a lot of conversations immediately following that outcome about what we thought were the opportunities to continue pursuing this strategy. And the Climate Disobedience Center was formed then with Tim DeChristopher and myself and those two defendants.
Let's talk about the Roxbury pipeline that you obstructed. I've only been to Boston once for the school segregation stuff years ago, but I remember Roxbury was a dense urban center and really an area for African-American people at that time. I wondered whether that's still the case, and is there an environmental justice, racist environmental situation here?
It's a good description of what Roxbury is today, and West Roxbury is where this pipeline was built. It's an entirely different neighborhood. The two neighborhoods don't even border one another. And so for people who live beyond the city of Boston, often that's not obvious. So the neighborhood of West Roxbury is more than three-quarters white, and it's mostly moderate and middle-income folks, and that's where the pipeline was being constructed. And so that's where we took the fight. There's, of course, a different kind of environmental justice lens in a mostly white neighborhood versus if it had actually been built through Roxbury. West Roxbury is densely populated, but not as densely as Roxbury. And this is actually one of the highest pressure pipelines to flow through an urban neighborhood that we know of.
And was this for fracking?
It was a 5-mile lateral built off of an existing pipeline that carries fracked gas from the Marcellus Shale region. So, you know, it was carrying gas from the frack fields to supplement the gas distribution system in the city of Boston that's owned by National Grid. And just one interesting thing to know is that National Grid, in helping Spectra to pursue this permit in the federal courts, had actually sent in a letter of support for the project, suggesting that they expected that the need for residential gas, the demand in the city of Boston, by the mid-2020s would be 12-fold what it is now. And none of us saw that until much, much later after the permit had been granted. But it was one of the reasons that FERC pointed to as there being a need for this gas. Whereas we know that if we would just fix all the gas leaks in the existing system, we would have more gas availability than we would need for the foreseeable future, because the demand is going down.
Are there a lot of leaks?
There are thousands of documented gas leaks in the city of Boston. And one of the defendants in this case is actually a gas leaks researcher. He's a scientist, a professor at Boston University, Nathan Phillips. And he's one of the people who first started documenting gas leaks. But he has a contraption he can affix to his car and drive the city streets and find gas leaks. And you can get online and search for a gas leaks map in Boston and find thousands of them.
How fascinating. Now, I understand that Spectra Energy was bought last year by the Canadian firm Enbridge Inc. Are they doing anything differently?
No.
And also, we're curious, in addition to the what we understand was nearly 200 protesters a couple of years ago, what's the response from the residents and the public? Are they opposed to this?
Yes, I would say that's nearly 200 people arrested. There were thousands of protesters in the streets in West Roxbury, and actually the community there, and including all of their elected officials, with the exception of Governor Baker, so the city councilors, the state legislators who represent West Roxbury, their member of Congress, Stephen Lynch, and their federal senators, were all actively publicly opposed to this pipeline and working to try to stop it. And many of them came and stood in the streets and cheered for the people who were blocking construction when it was happening, because they recognized that they had tried to engage all the lawful avenues in the regulatory system for preventing the construction of this pipeline. And the system is designed in order to make that impossible for communities to protect themselves. And so the residents of West Roxbury had, when they realized that they had reached the sort of end of their regulatory opportunities to stop this pipeline, reached out to some other folks to say, hey, we understand there might be some other strategies. We're not sure that we can lead those, but we hope that you would come in and do that. And a group called Resist the Pipeline was formed. I was invited to join that group in the middle of the summer of 2015, and join that team and to help get them organized. And then we began organizing a sustained campaign of nonviolent resistance to the pipeline, in which every day, as soon as construction started in the city of Boston, there was a vigil at the site of construction, which was always in the street, between 8 and 9 a.m., Monday through Saturday, and all of our supporters knew they could show up and stand with Mary Boyle and hold a sign, or she'd be there by herself with some extra signs. And there were a handful of people who did that almost every day with Mary, and others who dropped in and out. And then there were periodic and then more often actions where people showed up to block construction, and people from the neighborhood showed up to stand on the sidewalk and cheer for those actions.
Well, we're speaking with Marla and Kelsey from the Climate Disobedience Center and the Climate Defense Project. You know, when I heard about your victory, it was so thrilling, because the necessity defense is a rare one, and for it to prevail is really rare. Heidi and I had a friend called Len Wineglass, who was the great criminal defense lawyer in the movement years ago. He passed away 7 years ago. But he had a famous case up in Massachusetts, UMass, he had a number of clients, but the most famous one was Amy Carter, Jimmy Carter's daughter. And the students up at UMass used the necessity to defense. They had organized a sit-in to block the CIA from coming on campus. They were put up for trial, and the defense that Len Weinglass put forward was that the CIA was a criminal organization, and that under the rules of the university, criminal organizations couldn't be allowed to come on campus. And they had Howard Zinn as their expert witness, and they had a jury of rural folks up in Amherst, Massachusetts, and they actually won them over, and they prevailed on the necessity defense. And we were all thrilled. This is 20-some years ago, and now you folks have done it again, so congratulations.
Kelsey and Marla, I'm curious, did both of you have a sense in advance of how this judge would rule?
Kelsey, you want to go ahead?
I would say no. We were 100% prepared to have a necessity trial in this case. We didn't find out until 1 week before the trial date that that wouldn't be the case, so we were really focused on trial preparation. We did have the sense that this judge would be somewhat sympathetic to allowing us to bring in expert testimony and defendant testimony relevant to the necessity defense due to some of the pretrial proceedings in which she expressed concern about the risks posed by this pipeline. So we were prepared to have all of the defendants testify at length about what they had done and why they had done it. We had expert witnesses, including NASA scientist James Hansen, 350.org founder and author Bill McKibben, Jamila Rakib from the Albert Einstein Institution, who studies the effectiveness of civil disobedience, people who are experts on fracking, on the local impacts of this pipeline. So we were really focused on that. And then when the prosecutor's office chose to deprive us of that chance for a jury trial by downgrading the charges, we weren't sure what was going to happen after that. We hoped that our clients would have the opportunity to speak to the judge and speak to what they did as they did. But in terms of the judge's willingness to then go ahead and find them not responsible by reason of necessity, purely on the basis of that very circumscribed testimony, was a surprise.
Just Marla, I would add that the thing that I think brought us to that moment was the fact that we had been in the discovery process in an attempt to get a safety plan for the site from Spectra, which they had claimed for years that they had, and some other documents in the course of discovery, which the judge had ordered, suggesting to us that she was open to hearing that expert testimony relevant to the necessity defense. And I think that that one important thing for us and a lesson that I really learned is that although that we in all spent a year and a half in pretrial, but we saw this judge once a month, and so did the Spectra attorney, and he was pretty dismissive of the judge and spent a lot of time telling her she didn't know how to do her job and telling our attorneys that they needed to lay off with the constitutional rights stuff. And we showed up and demonstrated that we were serious, that this wasn't a stunt. And the judge at one point informed the Spectra attorney that it would be her decision as to whether or not we were granted a necessity defense, and that she had been discussing the question with one of her colleagues in another jurisdiction in Massachusetts who had granted a necessity defense for some protesters at Raytheon. So we knew that she was thinking about this question on her own and that she was seeing that we were serious. And so even though it was a long process, in the end, I think that showing our sort of humanity and our seriousness, as opposed to we were pulling stunts for a year in the streets in West Roxbury, probably made a difference.
We just have a few minutes remaining, and I think it would be a good note to end on if you could remind our listeners of the detrimental effects this will have on the local area and residents.
So if the pipeline operates as it is intended to, the primary impact on the local residents would be the periodic release of toxins from that are sort of planned and prepared for from this metering and regulating station that sits directly across the street from an active blasting quarry. But I think if the pipeline operates as intended, the primary locations for suffering and implications of this pipeline are going to be in the frack fields and in the places where the fracking wastewater is injected. And in general, in terms of the climate, all of us will be impacted, and other parts of the world way before this particular neighborhood. And if the pipeline doesn't operate as intended, situated with this metering and regulating station situated directly across the street from an active blasting quarry where they blast with dynamite once a week, if there's a catastrophic event at that facility, the estimated incineration zone blast radius is 30 city blocks. Not the radius. The total area is 30 city blocks.
Boy. I wanted to give you a moment to remind our listeners of how people can get a hold of the Climate Disobedience Center and the Climate Defense Project, and then just tell us for a moment what the two of you are working on now.
Climate Defense Project is online. You can go to our website at climatedefenseproject.org. We have a lot of resources there on the climate necessity defense, things for climate activists and communities who are interested in this type of work. We are working on a few upcoming cases. We have a couple opportunities coming up later this year in which we hope to be able to present the full climate necessity defense to a jury. One is in a Minnesota case that stems from the shut it down action by the valve turners in October 2016, in which they turned off the flow of Canadian tar sands oil into the U.S. Those activists have been in court in four different states, and in Minnesota, the trial court judge ruled that they could present the necessity defense, which is the first time that we've had a written ruling on that in a U.S. jury trial. That case is on pretrial appeal by the state right now, but we hope to have a trial sometime this summer. We'll hear more next month. We're also working on a case in Washington State where we similarly have the opportunity to present a climate necessity defense.
And the Climate Disobedience Center is also online. You can find us at climatedisobedience.org. We continue to work with folks all over the country who find themselves in alignment with our principles and the way that we approach disobedience in the time of a really serious build-out of fossil fuel infrastructure, recognizing that the status quo and business as usual is something that creates violence in all the places where it operates, but also in places very far and in places that we don't have to ever see if we don't make ourselves see it. So we're working with folks to try to unmask that violence that's going on right under our noses every day that we've learned how not to see. And we've just launched a project that we call Praxis Groups. We're piloting a few small groups in the Northeast now, and we hope to roll that out further as we sort of seek to improve the model continually. But we've recognized over the last couple of years that if we think it's time for people to take higher risks in order to get in the way of this runaway system, then more people need to have a sense of a community of support behind them. And so this is an intentional attempt to try to help people build those communities of support that ground them in the principles of nonviolent resistance and in the sort of moral imagination that could bring something beautiful into the work of trying to transform business as usual, so that we can build the systems we need instead of continuing to rely on the systems that have brought us energy that are really from the 19th century.
Well, Marla and Kelsey, if we were on TV, you could see the broad smile on Heidi's face and on mine. You two are doing terrific work. You know, keep causing trouble, and thanks so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Congratulations, both of you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Mm-hmm.